Had enough of the excuse-making, lack of accountability, and psychobabble? Then you're in the right place. You're listening to the Voice of Reason, and we're here to help you reconnect with your inner common sense. Now, here's the host of the Voice of Reason, Deneen Manette.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Tuesday of the Voice of Reason. I'm Deneen Manette, and I'm located up here in the Bay Area of California in a very beautiful spot today. And I have been doing this show for several weeks now. I'm enjoying myself. I'm hoping that you all are enjoying the topics and the commentary that we have set to discuss every week. I'm an infidelity expert. I'm a criminal investigator, worked in probation, worked in the 300 social service system, worked for government, Washington, done a whole lot of different things. And during the course of my education in life and in school, I went to UC Berkeley and got my degree from Hastings College of Law, my law degree. I've learned a lot, and I've been able to sit back and observe a lot. And it just seems like people miss the mark far too often for me. And that's kind of what motivated me to get into radio and to try and figure out where everyone is going wrong in their logical and reasonable and rational thinking. So anyway, I just want to take this hour every week to give my two cents about what I think is going on and my perspective and individual viewpoint on things. And this week, we're going to discuss what most people have been discussing this week is the Rachel Dolezal situation. And wow, what a mess that is. You know, I kind of feel like I want to say, Jesus, take the wheel. Anyway, it's just an absolute mess. If you have been under a rock for the last few days and don't know who Rachel Dolezal is, she's a woman who resigned actually recently from her post as president of the NAACP Spokane, Washington chapter. And actually, she appeared on the Today Show this morning. I don't know if anybody was able to watch that, but I saw a few clips from her appearance there. And I'm really glad that she has decided to come out and speak in her behalf, because a lot of people have been talking for her, including her own parents. And I always think it's important when somebody steps up and kind of gets control of the microphone and gets ahead of the rhetoric and maybe puts their own spin on something. I think that's really, really important if we are ever interested in finding out the truth or uncovering what really happened. It's always great to hear from that person. I wish Bill Cosby would take a page out of her book. But anyway, that's another topic for another day. Anyway, here's the basic story. Rachel, the president of the Spokane, Washington chapter, the NAACP, and for years, she has apparently been passing herself off as black. Now, her parents told the press that she is their birth daughter and that both of them are of European descent. They actually say that the press came to them and someone started asking them questions and that they are very religious people and are not going to lie. So they felt as though they were, you know, were going to tell the truth about exactly what her racial and cultural makeup is. And they say that she's German, she's Swedish, she's Czech, and that she's actually Native American. She's far less black, apparently, according to them, than she is Native American. She apparently stopped corresponding with her parents because, according to them, she was afraid they were going to expose her. And she's got four adopted African-American siblings. She went on to marry an African-American man and have a couple of kids, I believe, with him, and has apparently, according to her parents, reinvented herself as black. And I'm not really sure what the family dynamic is that's been going on or why it is that they felt the need to go on television multiple times now. And even now she's got some of her adopted siblings coming out and saying, you know, she pulled me aside and told me not to say anything. So I don't really know what the motivation behind all this is. It seems like there's a very deep-rooted family dynamic that has kind of gone haywire. But in any event, her parents have outed her, and they put it out there. Apparently, they don't want to have a relationship with her anymore because I kind of think that this is a deal-breaker. And she's now admitted that her parents, you know, are white. She's during the course of the time that she has been living her life as a black woman, she's been an adjunct professor of African American studies at Eastern Washington University. She went to Howard University, which is a predominantly black, you know, HBCU, a historical black college school, Howard University in Washington, D.C. And once again, she's been the head of the NAACP chapter in Washington. So my question is, I don't know. I'm just trying to figure out why everyone is so mad. This story really saddens me. It saddens me on a lot of different levels. But it really saddens me, just especially hearing her speak today, because there's just so much involved in this, and I'm just trying to get a handle on what the real issues are and where everybody falls in line in this entire story. And I think that as far as why everyone's mad, it seems to be kind of, it's twofold, quite frankly. And I guess the first complaint that people have been having, because I've been following this and I've been listening and I've been weighing in and giving my two cents, but it just seems like the first complaint is that people are upset that she was pretending to be black when she wasn't. And, you know, I mean, why not, basically? What's wrong with that? Let's figure out what's wrong with that. What difference does it make if a person is pretending to be black and they're not? I mean, apparently if she's, quote, down for the cause and she's committed to justice and equality, I mean, should it really matter what she is, quote, pretending, end quote, to be? You know, I mean, is it okay for Bruce Jenner to have been impersonating a man for so long when he was actually a woman, or vice versa? I mean, I don't know. Maybe he was impersonating a woman who's supposed to be a man. I don't know. Any event, you know, was it because he came out and said, you know what, I've been impersonating someone that I'm not, and therefore I think it's time that I told my true self? And is it because she didn't come out? Would it have been better if she had came out as a white woman who was impersonating a black person? Or, you know, was it harmful because she was outed? Is that the main issue? Is it because she was not honest and somebody found out? Or, you know, was it just because she was doing it at all? Would it have mattered if she had come out on her own and said, hey, this is me, this is what's going on? So, you know, but let me provide a little bit of history. So maybe this would make it a little bit easier for people to understand why a lot of people, especially those in the African American community, are upset about this. And so, you know, we need to go to historically speaking, what's the deal historically? I mean, from the beginning of time, the very early inception of cinema, whites played blacks in movies. I mean, there was this entire thing called blackface where, you know, whites put on shoe polish on their faces and pretended to be black characters. And why was this? This was because of the segregation and because white actors and actresses did not want to touch or interact with black actors and actresses. And the only way around having to touch or interact with them is to have a white person pretend to be black. So I know that sounds really just horrific, but we're not even talking 100 years ago, folks. We're not even talking that long ago. So this is not something that was from, you know, the 18th, 17th, 16th century, 100th century. So this is something that was not, like I said, even 100 years ago. This was in my grandparents' time. But like I said, white folks did not want to interact with black actors and actresses. So therefore, this was a great way to keep from that having to happen. And so this historically, blacks were played by white people, and this kind of takes a lot of people back to that. You know, does she look at this as a big game of, or a big example of someone playing in blackface? And black America has always had to deal with the white imagery of the white savior, white Jesus. White Jesus is everywhere, even though we know Jesus was reportedly an olive-skinned Jew. The depictions have always been this blonde guy with blue eyes, and here we are again, where black people just can't be themselves or recognized, where we have to have a white person playing somebody that is an olive-skinned Jew. And it's offensive. People are offended by that historically. This just kind of is a situation that goes along in lines of something that has happened over and over again. And once again, back to the movies and cinema, there's an entire culture of movies called white savior movies. And this has been going on forever, and it's still going on now. And folks in the African American community get tired of the white person riding in to save the day. What is exactly a white savior movie? It's where there's a white character who rescues this group of people of color from their plight. The white savior often learns something about themselves in the process of rescuing. They've learned that they're not as bigoted as they think they were. They've learned that they can understand and relate to people within a different culture. But they, in the process of saving the people of color, they learn something about themselves. But these stories also insinuate that people of color have no ability to rescue themselves. And this makes both white audiences feel good about themselves by portraying themselves as these benevolent messiahs. But they also, at the same time, depict people of color as helpless weaklings. And these films, I mean, some of this stuff is just so just underlying, you know, it's so subliminal that you don't really even notice that it's happening. And there's been so many films. I mean, I can list a few for you. The Air Up There was a 1994 film, and this was a disgraced basketball coach played by Kevin Bacon. He travels to an African village in Kenya to recruit. You know, Amistad, and that was in 1997, a group of African slaves, they commit mutiny, and then the white lawyer, John Quincy Adams, he defends their right to be free. Then The Blind Side, that was just a few years ago, in 2009, where Sandra Bullock played a white woman, a football fan, who takes in this poor black teenager into her home and supports him through high school and college. Now, that's actually a true story. But it's still depicting it goes along this whole white savior theme. Conrack, which was actually a movie that I enjoyed in college quite a bit, and this was a white teacher, this was a 1974 film. It was a white teacher who was sent off the coast of South Carolina where he teaches these poor black children from these poor black families and comes in and saves the day. Dangerous Minds, which we all remember from 1995. Michelle Pfeiffer played the white teacher who helps all the black and Mexican kids and saves the day. Even Django, you know, from 2012 with Jamie Foxx, where he's freed by this white German bounty hunter. You know, so this goes on and on. Finding Forrester, Glory, Freedom Riders, all of these are movies in which we have the white person that comes in and saves the black folks. Hardball, The Help. I mean, I can go on and on and on. But all of these critically acclaimed films are basically variations of the same narrative. And that is the black people are oppressed by the white people, and then they achieve freedom through the offices of the good white people. And, you know, it gets tiresome. And a lot of people are looking at this entire situation right now with Rachel as just kind of revisiting this same narrative over and over again. Here we are again. And unfortunately, you know, black people like to own their struggle. And, you know, sometimes that is to our detriment, but we like to own our struggle. And when someone kind of comes in and takes on the struggle or takes ownership of a past that they didn't have, it can be viewed as very offensive. And you know, yeah, we own our struggle. Sometimes it is to our own detriment. Sometimes we take on characteristics that are not positive and own them as part of the struggle. In other words, like if you speak with improper English, you're considered to be talking white or acting white. If you're acting, I guess, I don't know, you know, I don't know what acting white means. I suppose that means you don't have your pants sagging or whatever. I have no idea. But anyway, oh, there she is acting white again. Or, you know, you forgot where you came from if you're not living in the hood. No, everybody that's black did not come from the hood. So these are examples of black characteristics that have been embraced by many in the black community that are negative. They're negative stereotypes, but it's something that we consider being an ownership of our struggle and a camaraderie that we have, which necessarily is not always a good thing. But in any event, you know, you have to remain in the struggle. Otherwise, you lose, quote, street cred, quite frankly. And this is a situation where this person put herself at the front of a struggle that she basically didn't have. And people are offended by that. I mean, she has given herself a title and referenced herself as somebody who inherently was part of a struggle that she basically didn't have. It's kind of like somebody who jumps in the front of the line at Disneyland. It's kind of like when, you know, you're in line and you've been in line for 2 hours, and then all of a sudden somebody just kind of jumps in the front of the line. Now, if that person wasn't there, it wouldn't have made your waiting in line any easier. But is it fair when you've had to endure something and you've had to wait and you've had to been out there in that hot sun waiting for 2 hours to get on the Matterhorn, and then all of a sudden somebody jumps in the front of the line? You get kind of irritated. And I think that is kind of symbolic of the irritation that a lot of people are feeling, as though this woman, you know, jumped in the front of the line. Impersonating a person who has endured a struggle is in fact cheating. And And inviting this same person into intimate group and shared experiences only to find out that she hasn't paid her dues is kind of being viewed as the same as a line jumper. So, you know, that's one reason that people are upset. I know a lot of it's been kind of confusing, and it's been kind of, you know, people are trying to hash out why people are so mad, what difference it makes. She's out here and she's doing the work and she's committed to the cause. But once again, a lot of it lies in the cultural relevance of this, you know, always having to look for the white person to help us, number one. And number two, the fact that she's claiming to have had a struggle in the front of a line that she really, you know, had no business standing in the perception of a lot of people. Now, notice I keep saying a lot of people's perception. I'm not saying that this is necessarily is or is not mine. I'm just trying to help explain why some people are upset, because a lot of people don't understand why she's upset. Another reason people are upset is because they say she lied. They, you know, people feel like you don't have to be black to make a difference. You don't have to be black to lead a civil rights movement. Why is it that she felt that she needed to change her race and lie about it and lie about who her father was in order to help? There are plenty of white folks that have, through the years, gotten in, pushed their sleeves up and gotten to work. I mean, Obama was not elected by black people. Obama was elected by white people and others. I mean, that's just the honest to God truth, because we are too small of a percentage of the population to have elected a black president. You know, if you look at the movie Selma, you'll see that it wasn't until the white people looked at the television sets and saw the mistreatment of those marchers that they got involved, and that changed the narrative. So for blacks to act as though, you know, it's been our struggle and our struggle alone and the white people are not needed or wanted is foolishness. Because like I said, if you look through history, and everybody knows this, it was the collaboration of the races that is able to get things done. So people are feeling like, why did she lie? She didn't need to lie. She could have gotten in there and pulled up her sleeves and done whatever it was that she needed to do. She didn't need to have lied. She could have, you know, been a white person and still been committed to the cause, as many, many are. I've been looking at all these anti-police brutality rallies and things that are happening in the Bay Area where I live. And, you know, you find a sprinkling of African Americans, but basically it's people of all races out there. So you don't need to lie and say you're black. Is one of the issues with the lie. Secondly, people feel as though, you know, she used her black status to attain financial gain, getting a scholarship to Howard or maybe getting a job or whatever. But, you know, quite honestly, that's not true. She did have a scholarship to Howard, but when she attended Howard as a white person. She had not begun claiming black when she attended Howard University and got that scholarship. That scholarship was merit-based. It was not racially based, because quite frankly, Howard does not give scholarships to African Americans because of just simply for being African American. They'll give a scholarship for merit and for sports or for whatever, but not because you're black at a black university. They are trying to draw in people of other cultures and other races and other backgrounds. So just like other institutions give scholarships to somebody based on race in order to integrate their community, Howard is the same way. So for people to believe that she got a scholarship because she was pretending to be black is wrong for two reasons. Number one, like I said, Howard was not going to give her a scholarship solely because she's black. And number two, she was white when she went to Howard. So that, you know, that whole contention is not right. She was apparently still white with straight blonde hair, and she quite actually sued Howard. We've uncovered recently that in 2002, she reportedly accused Howard of discriminating against her as a white woman. And this report came out via the Smoking Gun that came out yesterday. When she was known as Rachel Moore, she named both Howard University and one of its professors, Professor Alfred Smith, I think his name was, as defendants in a lawsuit in Washington, D.C. Superior Court. She claimed Howard included discrimination based in her suit was discriminatory based on race, the fact that she was pregnant, family responsibilities and gender. She says that Howard improperly blocked her appointment to a teaching assistant post, and rejected her application for a postgraduate instructorship, denied her a scholarship aid while she was a student. And basically they removed her artwork, which was motivated by a discriminatory purpose in favor of African-American students over her. So basically, this lawsuit that she filed as a white woman contends that Howard was permeated with discriminatory intimidation, ridicule, and insult. She lost the suit and actually had to pay Howard back over $3,000 after it was dismissed, but she filed this suit as a white woman claiming discrimination because of the fact that she was white at an African-American institution, predominantly African-American institution. So perhaps the gain she received by claiming that she was African-American, maybe it was not so much about financial gain, but maybe she wanted to have more credibility and professional advancement into an area that she felt passionate about. Maybe she felt as though she needed to be viewed as more credible and that she needed to advance her and further her career, as many others do. So, you know, I'm wondering if maybe that's something that needs to be looked at, you know, because maybe it wasn't about her being a black person trying to get ahead. Maybe it was about the fact that being a white person, she felt as though she was not going to be able to do what she wanted to do and be passionate about what she wanted to be passionate about. So we're going to explore this a little bit further when we come back. And we're going to take a break right now, and we're going to get back to this in just a few moments.
Welcome back to The Voice of Reason. Here's Deneen Minette.
Hello, we're back again, and I'm talking about the Rachel Dolezal story. It's just something that's just really been fascinating. And by the way, let me, I always forget to give out the call-in line, which is 888-463-6748. That's 888-463-6748, just in case you have a comment that you'd like to make or a question or something if you want to join into the conversation. In any event, So I'm just wondering, you know, what her true motivation was. Was her motivation to just pass and be deceptive, which I don't think it was, or was her motivation to gain credibility and professional advancement, which I honestly think a lot of people do? I mean, how is that any different? How is what she did any different from a person who is gay, who pretends to be straight, in order to further their career in sports, on the football field, in media, in the corporate world, in politics? I mean, how often do we find out that somebody finally decided to come out as gay? And, you know, it's just a celebrated thing. It's wonderful that you're now living your true self. Why is it that it's so much more upsetting and disturbing that this woman has decided, in my opinion, to have done the exact same thing? That she decided to further her professional career and her passion in what she wanted to do by putting on the cloak of someone that she feels would have a better opportunity to do the things that she wanted to do. I don't see that she was going in there to take anything away. I think she was going in there to add. I just think that she did it all wrong, quite frankly. But how is she any different than, let's say, Dr. Dre or Jay-Z or any other rapper who's rapping about hood life, but they're living in the hills? They're living in gated communities. They're rapping about life on the streets and whatever. Some of them may or may not have ever even experienced that. Jay-Z may have, but I wonder how many are actually continuing this rhetoric and this dialogue and are putting on this persona of being, you know, in this thug life, street life, hoodlum life, gangster life, and are nowhere near being a gangster. In fact, as far as I know, they've moved as far away from gangsters as they could. The first thing you do when you get a little bit of money is pack up your bags and move to the hills. Because just because you're selling to these folks that are buying your music and eating it up and killing each other as a result, but that's another topic, that doesn't mean you actually are part of them. You're just putting on this gangster persona so that you can relate to them. How is that any different? I don't know that it is. I don't know that that's any different. These people are putting on a different persona to protect, to advance their careers and sell their CDs. and move their agenda along. And honestly, to make money. Rachel wasn't making any money. So, you know, I don't know how that's any different. How is this any different than that woman from ESPN, that reporter? Remember that ESPN sports reporter whose car got towed a few weeks ago? And she was ranting and raving and talking horribly, speaking horribly to the cashier, and was suspended for a week because she was just basically released her inner asshole because she allowed everyone to see that she was not the person that she pretended to be, the image that she projected, but basically was more of an elitist jerk, quite frankly. I mean, that side came out. Her inner asshole showed itself. So how is that any different than people in the media who put on this air of being very, you know, accepting and polite and nice and forgiving in all humanity, but then they act like an asshole when nobody's looking because that's who they really are. And that's why people get suspended. That's why people get fired, because of the fact that who they really are shows and rears its ugly head. It's no different to me. So people do this all the time. Bruce Dittert did it until he couldn't take it anymore. He did it until he couldn't take it anymore. He put on the persona as this guy, this father, this man, whatever it is that he's doing. He reinvented himself in order to make it happen. And when he couldn't take it anymore, it all fell apart. So it seems like what's, you know, when people are called on the carpet, like the ESPN lady, when people are called on the carpet for this, they get punished, as Rachel is being punished. When people just come out with it, like Bruce Jenner, then, or other people who've come out of the closet and it admitted, yes, you know, I'm gay or I'm this or I'm that, they seem to be celebrated. It's not so much, I guess, about the pretending to be something that you're not, as it is the not coming forward and acknowledging that you've pretended to be something that you're not. So maybe it's not the pretending as much as it is the hiding and failure to acknowledge that you've been pretending. I think that's probably what it is. Because, I mean, come on, people make personal adjustments for advancement purposes all the time. Is Nicki Minaj really blonde? Is she? Is that Beyonce's hair? Huh? What about all the fake butts and boobs out there? Good Lord, there's a whole bunch of them. Seen any lately? I have. So, you know, come on. I mean, honestly, my miracle bra, it has me pretending to be a C-cup, you know? Stone me, nail me to the cross. But the fact is that the fake eyelashes, the fake hair, the blonde, the lightening of the skin, the darkening of the skin, the fake butts, all of these things, boobs, whatever it is, people play a game of pretend all the time because it advances their career. And so for people to look down necessarily on someone who has maybe taken pretend game to a step farther, I'm not sure that's fair. I'm just not sure that that's fair, because it's something that everybody does in some form or fashion. You know, so I personally think, you know, because like I said, I haven't really weighed in on my personal feeling about it, you know, what's going on. But honestly, I think we need to look at where her heart was at. We need to evaluate this woman's heart. And quite honestly, she may have mental health issues, because this is to the extreme. I give you that. This is to the extreme. This may be one of those Munchausen by proxy things where somebody wants to be victimized so that they can get sympathy because they feed off of that. Like those women who victimize their own children so that they can get sympathy, that which is Munchausen by proxy. It may be a situation like that. It may be something that she's doing in order to reap the benefits of people feeling sorry for her for having had a struggle that she didn't have. I haven't seen that. To me, it just seems like she's a real strong worker bee. But, you know, there may be some mental health issues there. But at the end of the day, where was her heart? Was she doing something to advance the cause? Look at the big picture. It's not like a domestic violence advocate who's, you know, beating his wife at home constantly nonstop and coming out and preaching, you know, or even Mr. Duggar, who's out here professing to be, you know, so moral and high and mighty, but at the same time, you know, playing grab ass with his baby sister. So, you know, it's not that type of situation, or someone who is a staunch animal rights activist who you find out is conducting dog fighting at, you know, in their garage or something like that. It's not that type of situation. This is a situation where this person appears to have been truly committed and advancing the cause. I mean, she built a wide-ranging career as an expert on and advocate for the Black community. She really has. She's not just president of her local NAACP chapter. She is, like I mentioned earlier, she's an academic expert on African-American culture. She teaches many related classes, you know, of African-American studies at Eastern Washington University. She represents the Black community both publicly and quite vocally, including you being a spokeswoman on race-influenced police violence. She's on a police review committee board. And, you know, they're looking into whether there was some ethics violation because she checked the African-American box as one of her several boxes checked on her application to be on this police review ethics committee. I mean, at a police review board in which she looks at police brutality. She checked the wrong box and they're looking if there was any ethics violation. But I mean, come on. She's reviewing police brutality. Does it really matter if she's a Martian or if she is an illegal immigrant or if she's homeless, or what does it matter if she is committed to police brutality eradication? What does that matter? Why is that such a big deal? Why are we so color struck? Why are we so race struck that we cannot recognize when somebody is on your team? Just because they don't look like you, that doesn't mean that they're not on your team. I have a page in my book. I wrote a book called Messages for Joey, by the way, and it's everything I want my daughter to know. And one of the most important pages in that book says, everyone who looks like you is not your friend, and everyone who doesn't is not your enemy. So basically, just because someone is not of your ilk, does not look like you, dress like you, eat like you, speak like you, that does not automatically make them against you in the other camp. So what difference does it make if she checked the wrong box? If she's out there advocating for police to quit kicking people's asses, what difference does it make? So that's why I find this to be so incredibly sad. You know, on this past Tuesday, she spoke to Al Jazeera on the topic of police brutality. You know, she's appeared alongside Baltimore City State Attorney Marilyn Mosby, the woman who just filed the charges against the police officers in the death of Freddie Gray, you know, the young Black man who got into the ambulance yelling and got out with a broken back. Anyway, she was standing up there alongside her, the state attorney general, Marilyn Mosby. You know, so I'm of the opinion that we really need to give this woman an opportunity to explain her motives. I think we need to put the pitchforks away. She's not Bernie Madoff. She's not someone who was stealing money from old people. She's not even anybody who was in the tills and in the coppers of the NAACP. I haven't heard a single report about her misappropriating funds or her having an alternate agenda. I haven't heard anything about that. You know, it seems like she was advocating for the cause of the good guys. I understand the historical perspective. I understand what people are sick and tired of. I get that. I understand that you feel like she was a line jumper. I get that. But if the person that jumped in front of the line at Disneyland was there because they needed to perform CPR on somebody that was having in distress in the front of the line, or if it was somebody that was perhaps, I don't know, advancing a cause in some way, does it matter that much? I think we just get so polarized and we just get so hell-bent and stuck in our individual perspectives about how things should run, how things should be, who's entitled to do this and that, and why, you know, this or that person should or shouldn't say certain things or do certain things, that we don't look at the big issue. We're so busy fighting that we don't recognize when somebody is actually fighting next to us and not against us. Yes, I believe this woman may have mental health issues. I've said that before. Yes, I believe that you know, she should have just said, you know what, I'm a white woman and this is what I believe is important. But she said today on the Today Show that she identifies as African American. That's what she said. How can we tell her that she doesn't? She says that's who she sees herself as. Bruce Jenner, Caitlyn Jenner can now walk into a woman's restroom and people seem to be okay with that. If that's how he honestly and truthfully identifies, that's something that everyone's been open to. So for this woman to stand up and say, I self-identify as an African-American, and no, she's not been through all of the struggles, but who's to say that all African-American-born individuals have been through all the struggles? Do you actually think Magic Johnson's children have been through all the struggles that regular African-Americans in the hood have? Do you actually think that Michael Jordan's kids, Oprah Winfrey's closest friends, or do you actually think that every African American has lived through the struggle? They haven't. So does that mean that we're going to allow them to come in just because of the color of their skin? Yes, I understand when you walk out into the community, nobody knows that you're rich or affluent and you are judged by your African American skin. I get that. But for all intensive purposes, this woman put on black skin and black hair and was surrounded and even was filed a police report about having been racially harassed. I don't know if it's true or not, but if so, if it is true, then yes, she's got her own struggles. So just because somebody does not look like you, if their heart is in the right place, I really think that it would do us all some good to be able to step back and evaluate whether or not it is in our best interest to be more inclusive as a people in a common struggle that we are all in for justice and equality and fair treatment. You know, I'm wondering if it may be more productive and proactive and representative of the world we are trying to further by maybe just taking a deep breath, calming down, not looking for the offense in every single interaction. If you're looking to be offended, you're gonna find it. If you're always in search of being mistreated, you're gonna find it. Whatever you look for, all just passionately and avidly and constantly, if you're looking for something all the time, sooner or later, you're gonna find it. And this is a situation that I think, quite honestly, is really being blown out of proportion. I actually find a lot of it to be pretty funny. I actually have gone through a lot of the things that are online and a lot of the funny things that I've read, and I have laughed about it. All of this hashtag Ask Rachel, where people are posting online, African Americans are posting online different questions to ask Rachel to see if she's really black. Like, there's a Cool Whip container and it says, what's in this container? A, Cool Whip. B, last night's leftover greens from dinner. That's hilarious to me because that's basically showing a commonality amongst African Americans that no matter where you're from or where you were raised, the chances of that container having greens in it and not Cool Whip are really, really high. And I have laughed. I laughed all day Friday. I laughed all day Saturday at how funny the African American experience is. How funny and how much fun and how enjoyable it is to share in this culture. And it's been, to me, it's been an enlightening opportunity to start this dialogue and to recognize that we as a culture that has been divided on many levels are a lot closer than it appears a lot of times. A lot closer than we recognize, whether you're living in the hills, whether you're living in the hood. And I've actually enjoyed the camaraderie that this entire dialogue has brought. So I think we all just need to step back. We need to take a deep breath. We need to relax and we just need to roll with this a little bit. I think we just are too heightened in our desire to be offended and we just need to just relax and look at the big picture. This woman was trying to help. Why should we deny her that opportunity? When we come back, we're going to switch gears and go into our infidelity question of the week.
And now back to Deneen Minette for more of the Voice of Reason on TalkZone.com.
Hello, it's Deneen Minette. I'm back for our final segment of the Voice of Reason for this week. I've been in the infidelity community for almost 20 years. And as a support group organizer, as someone who does a lot of online interacting, a lot of question and answer type things, I've done forums and groups and things of that nature. And it's a very near and dear topic for me. It's something that I have personal experience with, as well as professional, working as an investigator. And that's pretty much the way that my first book reads. It's all about uncovering infidelity, recognizing the signs, and how to deal with infidelity in a relationship when you are suspicious that your spouse or partner is fair or physical. Those are two different things, but they often end up one and the same. And how to work through that. It's a very, very difficult thing. And a lot of times people are so embarrassed and ashamed, and they feel like they're suffering in silence, especially men. I often find that I get an awful lot of questions from my male callers or male emailing me, because we as women, we discuss these things with our friends, with our mothers, with our sisters and coworkers. But men, they don't. They look at it as a sexual inadequacy, and they don't talk about it. You know, each week I try to address at least one question regarding infidelity and give my perspective on it. So this week's question is coming from Janice. And Janice writes, she says, "I think my husband is cheating, but I have no idea who the other woman might be. We've been married for almost 6 years, and he recently started a new job at an investment banking firm. He's been working really long hours, our work in the past. It seems that he started coming home later and later every night, and a lot of times he claims that he was forced to go out for drinks with his boss and other folks from the firm and whatever, but I'm not sure that I really believe that. I am a stay-at-home mom of a 1- and a 3-year-old, and it seems like my husband and I never spend time together anymore. When he's at home, it seems like he's either on the computer, or he's asleep, or he's staring at the television. He only wants to talk about work, and honestly, after the day I've usually had with the kids, I really don't want to hear about what happens at work. Sometimes when he takes phone calls, he leaves the room, and he talks in quiet, hushed tones like he has something to hide from me. We rarely have sex anymore, and he just seems generally distant. I don't know if he's having an affair, but I don't know what else could be causing him to act this way all of a sudden. What do you think? Is he cheating?" Well, I don't know if he's cheating. I have no ideas. So let's just take this part piece by piece, and maybe we shed on some things. We can figure out if he's cheating, because I don't know him. And the easiest person, it's easiest for the person to determine if someone's cheating if that person is in the relationship, because you know your husband's habits, you know his moods, you know his behaviors and the way that he deals with things, and you can get an overall read of your husband. You've known him for at least 6 years, because that's as long as you've been married. And during the course of time, that person becomes your soulmate, your best friend, or at least somebody that you are very much in tune with. Just like your children, you know they're lying. You know when something's right with them or when someone has hurt their feelings. They wear their emotion on their shoulders. But our spouses wear emotion in a way that we can detect what's going on with them as well. And a lot of times we ignore obvious signs or obvious signs. Either don't want to deal with them, or we don't really recognize them. And I have learned over the years of having run this support group and having dealt with people in this field that 95% of the people that have been involved with a spouse who has had an affair say after the fact that they recognized the signs, but they just chose to ignore them, that they saw the signs, that they picked up on the subtle clues, but that they just didn't pay attention, they didn't want to pay attention, or they just hoped that it would go away. So usually it's the spouse that picks up, you know, the first clues that something is going on in the marriage. So that's why I'm just asking you to take an overall assessment of your relationship. And it seems like that's what you've done. A lot of times, affairs are born of change, of stress in the relationship. And one of the three main stressors in any relationship are unmet needs, unexpected differences, and harbored resentment. Those are three main marital stressors. And when you're in a situation where those things are beginning to permeate the relationship, they can cause a relationship to be stressed, intimacy to break down, and in a relationship or an individual in the relationship is particularly vulnerable to solving their problems outside as opposed to dealing with them on the inside, then your relationship is ripe for an extramarital affair. So these are things that are across the board that cause relationships to start to break down. Because as I've said numerous times, that an affair is not typically the problem. It is a symptom of a greater problem. So if you can identify what the greater problem is, then often you are halfway to recognizing what's going on and fixing your relationship. So it seems that you've pointed out several things in this, in your story that lead me to be concerned. Number one, your husband has started a new job, and an investment banker job is really stressful. I mean, that job is contingent upon the market. It's contingent upon a lot of factors that change day by day, hour by hour. So just the nature of that job. You didn't say that he was working as a park ranger in Yosemite. You're saying that he's working a very stressful job, and this is a new job. So this right here is something new that has come into the relationship, and that can be causing him a degree of stress. That could be causing him to be concerned. It may be something that he's not comfortable in, that he doesn't feel as though he's got a good grasp of just yet. And so it concerns him that, you know, he might not be able to provide for the family. You are a stay-at-home mom. That is a lot of stress on one individual to have to balance the entire financial portfolio of the household. So that may be something that's causing him a lot of anxiety that he's not expressing to you. The fact that, number one, he's got this new high-stress job, and number two, that it's a new job that he's got to make it in. Otherwise, you guys aren't going to eat. I mean, you're not working, and you're at home doing something fabulous, taking care of the kids, which is a wonderful career, job, whatever. It's very important to the family, but it's not bringing in any income. And men get really, really concerned when their professional life is off track. So if he's in transition and he's in transition into a very stressful job, it could be a stressor in the marriage and a stressor in the relationship. The fact that you all aren't having intimacy anymore, the fact that he's pulled away and you aren't having sex anymore, tells me that there's a breakdown in the intimacy. And if an affair is not on the horizon, the fact that your marriage is starting to experience disconnect is something that you really need to address, and you need to address it like yesterday. So he's coming home later every night. And once again, when you're in these type of professions, you are expected to, you know, tote the party line. You're expected to be part of the boys. You're expected to get out there and do a lot of mingling and socializing and portfolio building and client interaction. So there is a lot of this, you know, socializing events, going to the bar, going to dinner, having meet and greets and all types of functions that he's going to be expected to attend, because this is a new job for him. He's got to build up his name. So this is going to be happening. He's going to be coming home late. And I don't know, I can't say for sure that he's met somebody else, but I can say for sure that he has met a new job with an awful lot of expectations being presented to him by those who are above him and those that he needs to impress. He's got to build up the client portfolio. He's got to do a lot of networking. And that's not going to happen between 9 to 5. That's going to happen after hours. This is the profession that he has chosen, and it comes with, you know, benefits, but it also comes with detriments. And one of them may end up being the detriment to the intimacy of your relationship. You being a stay-at-home mom, I've heard from a lot of stay-at-home moms that, especially with kids that are 1 and 3, my children, my boys were 2 years apart. And between 1 and 3, good Lord, I was pulling my hair out. You couldn't even say the word hi-ya in my house, because hi-ya was followed by somebody screaming, crying, bleeding, crashing, breaking, whatever. So that is very, very stressful. So I'm sure that at the end of the day, you probably just want to push the kids off on him. Or you want to talk about, you know, who pooped their pants or who spilled all their Cheerios or whatever. Or, you know, you're probably not having an awful lot of adult interaction during the day. So I'm sure you're probably hitting him with some things when he's coming home too. So this is him coming home from this stressful job and having to work late. You having been with these little kids all day, and the day has gotten longer now, and probably not feeling as though you're getting very much help and support out of him, which he's working his own job. He really just can't provide to you right now. This is the makings. This is beginning to be a perfect storm for a marital disaster, quite frankly. This is the beginning of a complete disconnect, a total breakdown of intimacy, and it leaves your marriage vulnerable for extracurricular activities, either on his part or, honestly, on your part. If he's coming home and he's watching TV and on the computer, he's either tuned out and just watching some reality programming and just trying to have some mind-numbing experience, or he's still working when he gets home. So, you know, these are things that it means that he's just, he doesn't really have a place where there's an opportunity for him to just exhale, or he's asleep. And that's not helpful to you because you've got these kids and you're really kind of hoping that he can interact with them. And that's probably stressful to you as well. And then when he wants to talk about his job, you don't want to hear about his job. That's understandable. He probably doesn't want to hear about yours at home during the day either. And if the person who's closest to you is not interested in what's going on in your day-to-day life, then somebody else will be. And if you're not taking at least expressing a small amount of interest in what's going on in his day-to-day world, someone else is going to be interested in that. No one should be more interested in what is going on with your husband than you. I need to say that again. No one should be more interested in what is going on, especially no other woman, than you. And that woman will find herself in his life. Not saying that she already hasn't, but the way you've laid out this question, it leads me to believe that it hasn't happened, but that your marriage is now vulnerable to it happening. So this is what I need to suggest to you all. You guys need a break. You need to get some family members, some close friends, somebody that can take over these kids for a few hours, at least once a week. You guys need to take some time. Now, I know they're very young. Not sure if anybody's still nursing, breastfeeding, whatever. I don't know. So I'm not suggesting that you take some long weekend away or anything like that. But I am suggesting that the two of you have some time set aside every week to reconnect. And maybe reconnect and not talk about the kids, if that's possible, and not talk about his job, but to talk about things you all want to do together, places you want to go, and reconnect on that intimate level. You were married for at least 2 to 3 years before the first baby was born. So there was something that you all used to do. Whether it's go, you know, join a gym and taking an exercise, you know, working out together, doing yoga together, not going to a movie because you don't interact at a movie, but going out to dinner, taking a long walk. My parents used to walk every single night. Sometimes they'd walk for 10 minutes. Sometimes they'd walk for 2 or 3 hours. I never saw my parents argue, and I know it was because that while they were on those walks, they were hashing out things that were going on in the household, away from the children. They were reconnecting, and I truly believe and have learned after the fact, as I, you know, since I've become an adult, that was the time my mother said they used to have knockdown drag-em-outs in other people's front lawns. I mean, just basically where they would just go at it and get this stuff off their chest and work through whatever was going on financially, maritally, whatever, and were able to come home and present a united front. It is really, really important that you and your husband reconnect and be able to come home and present a united front. I know that there is some sister, some mother, some hired babysitter, for Christ's sake, somebody that can come in, maybe even after the kids go to bed. You know, they're still quite young. I'm assuming that they have a pretty good bedtime, maybe 8, 9 o'clock or whatever, but just set some time aside away from the home, away from the dishes. If you're sitting there having a conversation with your husband in the kitchen, you're going to constantly be looking over at that pile of dishes. You're going to be constantly looking over at that pile of laundry that needs folding. He's going to be looking at his phone. He's going to be looking over at the computer. It's not going to be an intimate opportunity to connect and to rebuild. Your marriage is slipping away from you, Janice. Your husband is slipping away from you. And this can absolutely be fixed. This is absolutely salvageable. This is completely and totally something that you can get back, but you cannot ignore this and just let it go. Like I said, I don't know if he's having an affair. I'm not even going to address whether or not he's having an affair, because if he is, you need to reconnect with your husband. And if he doesn't have time for you at home and the kids and everything else, I guarantee you he doesn't have time and energy for an affair right now. So if this is a new job, if this is all something new, if it's something that he's just started up with another woman, then it's something that can be ended and you all can reconnect on a level that is important and is completely essential to your household. You've got these two babies. You've got these great young children, and they need you. They need a united front. They need strong, healthy parents in their home. And the only way to get that done is for the two of you to find a way to reconnect, to revisit your intimacy, and to sort out a time, carve out time that is absolutely critical for your marriage, the health of your marriage, and the welfare of your marriage. Okay, so that's it today. We're done for the week, folks. I will be back next Tuesday, same time, same place, talking about whatever, you know, is on the forefront of the Yahoo page, webpage, whatever it is that's coming up. We'll address it. We'll talk about it. We'll get it done, worked out, hashed through. Thank you so much for joining me today, and I will see you all next week.